Afternoon, everyone. My name is Bassam Haddad, and I am joined by my co-host, Adam Horowitz. And we are very delighted to be hosting our fourth guest today in Israel's Endgame, Dr. Ilan Pape. I will introduce both of my colleagues in just a minute. I just want to confirm that this is a series that is produced by Jadalia and the Gaza in Context Project and co-sponsored by MondoWise. And we are going to be speaking with several other guests in the coming weeks. Let me get to my guest, to my co-host first, Adam Horowitz, who is managing editor of MondoWise, an independent website covering news, politics, and debate around Palestine. Adam was the co-editor of the Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict, and Lizzie Ratner and Philip Weiss with Lizzie Ratner and Philip Weiss, and has been active in Jewish anti-Zionist movements for the last two decades. And before I introduce Ilan, let me just say welcome, Ilan, and welcome, Adam. How are you guys doing?
Very well, thank you. It's great to be on your show, Bassam, and with Adam.
Adam, yeah. Do you want to...
Thank you. Looking forward to the conversation.
Absolutely. Of course, I have to say that it goes without saying that many of you probably, if not all of you, know exactly who our guest is. Ilan Pape is a professor of history at Exeter University and the author of many books, including his latest, Israel on the Brink, 8 Steps for a Better Future, a book that we will be discussing today as we move forward. He is the founder and co-director of the European Center for Palestine Studies. Pape obtained his BA degree from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem in 1979, and doctor in philosophy from the University of Oxford in 1984. He founded and directed the Academic Institute for Peace in Givat Haviva. Please correct any pronunciation I might mess up. Israel, in Israel between 1992 to 2000, and was the chair of the Emil Tuma Institute for Palestine Studies in Haifa between 2000 and 2006. Pape was a senior lecturer in the Department of Middle Eastern History and the Department of Political Science in Haifa University. Between 1984 and 2006, he was appointed as chair in the Department of History in the Cornwall campus 2007 to 2009, and became a fellow of the IAIS in 2010. His research focuses on the modern Middle East, and in particular, the history of Israel and Palestine. He has also written on multiculturalism, critical discourse analysis, and on power and knowledge, a very important topic which will come up today. I am, people say this a lot when they host guests, but I'm sure Adam and I are really honored to have you, Ilan, with us. It is very rare to speak of a person's name and legacy and receive the kind of responses, really wonderful responses from across the spectrum when your name is mentioned, and that's for a very good reason. So ahlan wa sahlan, welcome.
Thank you.
Ilan, we want to start, as we do with all our guests, and that would be the question, the very basic question about whether Israel, generally speaking, or Israeli decision makers believe they can pursue the policies of expansion, dispossession, apartheid, military occupation, and slow motion genocide, if you will, in Palestine and beyond forever. So this is our starter, and we'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Again, thank you so much, Bassam and Adam, for having me on this program. There is a difference, of course, between what the current political elite and ideological elite in Israel will attempt and what it will be able to achieve. These are two different, I think, themes. They, as far as they are concerned, and they're not entirely homogeneous, and I will say something about that. But in generally, as a group that has very strong common features, they do believe not only that they have the power to continue with de-Arabizing, if you want, historical Palestine, namely beginning with moving out as many Palestinians as possible from the Gaza Strip, and in a more incremental way, ethnically cleansing the Palestinians from the West Bank, and with more soft methods, putting pressure on the Palestinian citizens of Israel to leave. Not only they think they have the capacity and ability to do this, they believe that they are in an historical window, if you want, a moment, that allows them to do this without too many repercussions. Namely, an Arab world that is still seeking to normalize relationship with them, a Palestinian movement that is still fragmented, a Europe that is at least a right-wing Europe, if you want, that endorses, as they see it, this kind of vision, a more central and left Europe that is too timid to do anything about these policies, and of course, people like President Trump, President Modi, who is right now in Israel from India, who definitely are giving almost a carte blanche to that kind of policy. So this is what they will try and do. And to answer directly your question, Bassam, yes, they think they can go on with it for a very long time. Will they succeed is, of course, a very different question. And I don't think they will, but until they will fail, and that's the greatest worry for all of us, they have the potential of inflicting so much damage and suffering, especially on the Palestinians, but not only on the Palestinians, that, of course, one will have to discuss later on, I suppose, not only in this forum, in any other forum, the urgent need to at least tame them, limit them, if not altogether stop them from implementing this vision and this kind of strategy.
That is a perfect start to this conversation. And I think we're going to be returning to a lot of those questions and themes. But I would like to start. You are, as Bassam alluded to, and as many of the people watching this know, just the one of the preeminent historians of the Zionist movement of Israeli state. And so I'm curious if you could help contextualize for us this moment within this the history of Zionism. We're talking about this as, what is Israel's end game? Can Israel achieve these ambitions? How do what we're seeing now, how does it go back to the pre-state period, the Nakba, and the earlier parts of Zionist history?
Yeah, thank you, Adam. I think it can be contextualized by looking at the Zionist project from its inception as facing two basic challenges that it's still facing today. It had faced it in the very beginning of its inception, and it's still with it today. And both of them emanate from the early historical context. We should consider that Zionism, after all, was a European project in response to Europe's inability to deal with its anti-Semitism or its racism towards Jews, and as an antidote to anti-Semitism, it created a coalition with a lot of other stakeholders, of course, who supported it for other reasons. Imperialism, capitalism, and so on. But the core idea was that Europe, even after the genocide of the Jews, is unable to offer the Jews a Europe that is safe from anti-Semitism. It's much better even for Europe to support the idea of colonizing Palestine as a solution. From that, two challenges emanated. One, the one that I think most people are immediately aware of, that to impose a European Jewish state at the heart of the Arab world on the Palestinians against their will, at the time when the Palestinians themselves are seeing themselves as a nation with ambition for self-determination and independence is a challenge that you can only solve by coercion and force, by dispossession, by becoming a settler colonial project, which what Zionism became. Now, the challenge is both geographical and demographic, namely, you want to take as much as you can of the indigenous land, which Zionism succeeded eventually in 1967, but you also want to make sure that demographically you are in control, whether by being the absolute majority or by building political system where it doesn't really matter if demographically you don't have the kind of majority that you want, provided that the other group that you don't want, if it is not expelled, it doesn't have basic human and civil rights. Now, between these kind of options of how to deal with an indigenous people of a homeland that were not willing to give way to this idea of imposing on them a Jewish European state, Zionism was looking for basically two kinds of orientations, I would say, from its very beginning. One was believing, and I think some of them genuinely believed, that there's a way of squaring a wish to be a democratic state in the end of the day, and yet at the same time a racist ethnic state. Somehow it should work. Most of the political parties in Israel that would define themselves as central or left would say, we are all supporting Jewish democratic, Israel as a Jewish democratic country. This totally failed. You cannot really square racism with democracy, you cannot square colonialism with progressive ideas, and you cannot justify ethnic cleansing through socialist or liberal universal values. So this was not working. The second orientation that was there more on the margins said there's no need for trying to square. What we need is power and force, and then get the land without the people, as much as we can. And I think what happened because of the failure of the earlier orientation, as I said, some of it was genuine. I really think they really believed they could do that. Nowadays, Zionism has totally abandoned, as an ideology, has totally abandoned the earlier attempts of squaring universal values with the ethnic racist ambition of a settler colonial project, and totally gave in to the logic and raison d'etre of a settler colonial project, namely you want the land without the people, whatever means possible. Now that is the first challenge, and I don't have to tell your viewers or you that the challenge produced cycles and cycles of violence, the resistance to it, the counter resistance, and we've seen what happened in the last 2.5 years that really brought probably the worst cycle so far. Although, of course, when the historical moment arrived in 1948, even the democratic liberal Zionists, if you want, thought that they could not resist the temptation to massively expel as many Palestinians as possible, given that particular moment in history. The incompletion of that moment in many ways led them to continue incremental ethnic cleansing and oppression while hoping that somehow it doesn't undermine the democratic ambition. The second challenge, which is less visible, I think, to viewers and people who are interested or generally are concerned in what goes on in Israel and Palestine, is the challenge that Zionism created to Judaism. The idea that you can redefine a faith as nationalism, and not only as nationalism, but as an ideology of a nation state. This is something that does not really relate immediately to the problem vis-a-vis the Palestinians. It is an internal problem of a society that somehow, again, thinks that you can square religious identities with secular views that emanate mostly from Western philosophies of freedoms, of democracies, of human rights and civil rights. And what you have is that from the failure of the challenge the Palestinian post to Israel grew a failure of the challenge to claim that you have found a way of making Judaism an acceptable form of nationalism to all the Jews who live in Palestine, in historical Palestine. And it turns out that for many Jews, whether those who came from North Africa, whether for those who grew up in the illegal settlements in the West Bank, whether they come from Orthodox community that Zionized themselves throughout the history of Israel, it doesn't matter where they come from, they feel that a Jewish state is a theocratic state, is not, cannot be, you can't, the, can, it's, impo- it's for them, it's an oxymoron to have a secular Jewish life, either in the public space, but even in the individual life of people. The two are fusing together, the idea that you have to make Israel more theocratic and you have to make Israel a more imperialist in its ambition, not only towards Palestine, but even beyond Palestine, go together because it's built on a model that this ideological new elite in Israel has in mind, which is based on their reading of the Old Testament as an historical document that gives you all the elements of success, as they would see it, of Jewish sovereignty, namely theocratic life domestically and a mini empire in the area externally. And they really believe that they are resurrecting the kind of kingdom that, by the way, I don't think existed. It doesn't matter. The way they think that that's what they can glean out or understand from reading the relevant passages in the Old Testament about it.
If I may ask, Ilan, we've all, you know, addressed these topics and we've spoken with many guests about the topic of Zionism and the kind of you know, sort of conclusion that you alluded to in terms of what was happening within Israel and how they gave up a certain kind of, you know, narratives. Can you tell us a little bit about the timeline? When did these sorts of changes within Israel regarding theory and theory, at least, but also practice, mm-hmm. in relation to the term ideology Zionism. When did these things happen, and what is the significance today in Israel of the term or of the ideology?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's an incremental process. It doesn't erupt in one day, and there are stages. I think an important stage that happened was the occupation of the West Bank in particular, less the Gaza Strip, in 1967. It created the first kind of a novel messianic Zionist ideology that actually, since the West Bank includes the biblical towns, or as even secular Jews in 67 would have put it, it includes the heart of the nation, that maybe there is much more to the Zionist project than just the project of saving Jews from anti-Semitism or building a settler colonial state that is closely associated with the West in the Arab world. It became something much more messianic and therefore much less secular on the one hand and far more racist in an active way towards the non-Jewish population. So that was one thing. I think the annexation, the de facto annexation of the West Bank, not the formal one. I think another moment which is important is the distortion or the kind of distorted image that the Oslo Accord planted in the minds of Israelis. The narrative that all of Israelis, whether on the right or on the left, accepted was that Israel was unprecedentedly generous in what it offered the Palestinians in 1993. And the Palestinian missed the opportunity to build on this Israeli generosity, betrayed the generosity by choosing terror over peace. And therefore, the lesson from this is, let's not even try this again. We need a different kind of language. Projecting internal Israeli values on the Palestinians, for instance, saying, well, it seems the only language the Palestinians understand is the language of force, for instance, right? I think what is more difficult to time, apart from saying the period, namely in terms of exact dates, are the processes that began from 1977 onwards, when there was a fusion between right-wing Zionist ideologies that were closer to the right-wing ideologies of the West, some of them even close to fascist ideologies in the West, that European Jews brought with them, and their connection to the very complex predicament of the Jews who were brought from the Arab countries and the Muslim countries to Israel in the 1950s. These communities were pushed to the geographical and social margins of Israel and were treated in a very racist way by the more veteran European Jewish settlers and early citizens of the State of Israel. And this connection between fascist right-wing Israeli politics and the frustration and sense of, I would say even inferiority, of the Arab Jews, who were already then in the 70s, but definitely even today, substantial number and substantial part of the Jewish society, created this idea that not only the Palestinians are the enemy of making Israel a thriving place, but also the secular European Jews are the enemy. And they all bought into the idea that any reaction, any negative reaction in the West or anywhere else in the world to their right to build a de-Arabized and more theocratic and more racist Jewish state is a new form of anti-Semitism. This is an ideology of racism. I mean, if you ask the last bit of your question, it's a mixture of a certain theocratic idea with a very blatant form of Jewish racism and supremacy, I would say, but one that cannot be separated from white supremacy ideologies and orientations. So it's not always easy to, you know, people try to unpack and say it is Jewish supremacy, it's not white supremacy, or vice versa, and so on. I think ideologies of hate and racism that produce violent acts are far more a composite of ideological influences that only that you can you cannot only tie it into one source of influence, you know. So this whole mixture of a third generation, especially of North African Jews, many of them tended to become more Orthodox Jews, to become more religious Jews, if you want, with the kind of freedom to be vigilantes and violent in their culture and mentality that the settlers in the West Bank have enjoyed in recent years, together with the ideology of right-wing Israelis who are more can be likened more easily to the new right in the West. And on top of it, connecting with this person who is totally opportunistic and only cares about staying in power, Benjamin Netanyahu, all that together created a mixture that apparently is attract it has two faces or two aspects to it. One, as terrible as it sounds, and to my mind, as superficial as it sounds, it's attractive to quite a lot of intelligent people in the Israeli Jewish society. It affects people in the highest position in the Secret Service, in the police, in the political system, in the educational system, in the media. It begins to be quite prominent in the academia. It is still not totally kind of swallowing the judicial system, but that might happen in any given moment. That's one aspect. And the second aspect is that those who oppose it for whatever reasons, because they want Israel to be more pluralistic, more democratic, maybe are still hoping for some sort of a dialogue with the Palestinian, that kind of society, call it the more liberal one, call it the more peace-orientated part of the Jewish society, are losing the battle against this other Israel. And losing it in the streets, it's losing it in politics, it's losing it in the media. It's also losing it because they're leaving Israel in huge numbers. And we don't have the exact number, but we know it's a huge number. And it's not just the number, it's also the kind of place that they occupy in the society, which is important. So you have this timeline that I would say begins in 2000, more or less, when all these discrete groups that I was talking about, you know, third generation of Arab Jews, settlers ideologues, ideologues on the more veteran right wing in Israel, you can add to it immigrants who came from Russia and the former Soviet Union with fascist ideas, and some people from the United States and from post-apartheid South Africa were looking for another apartheid system instead of the one they lost. All these discrete groups fused together into a far more solid ideological movement the moment they had a guru, the moment they had a clear leader. And that leader became Netanyahu in 2009. Not Netanyahu of the first term in office, between 1992 to 1996. He didn't have that kind of charisma and influence of that alliance. But since 2009, he is the missing element to make them kind of fuse together to an electoral force and now an ideological force. It is so powerful that even if Netanyahu loses the next election, which is quite possible, this ideological stream, to my mind, will continue to dominate Israeli politics, culture, and society.
Yeah, this is fascinating. And I want to stay on this topic. And there's a few data points just from this past week, which I think speak to it. But first, I want to sort of contextualize this question with, and at the beginning when you were talking, and I think this is an idea that has long been talked about these internal contradictions between Jewish-Israeli society within Israel, democratic versus Jewish, can't be a democratic and Jewish state, of course. Hearing you talk, it sounds to me as though that those contradictions, though, have more or less been resolved in this fascist direction. And these two there was a poll done by Israel's Channel 12 of first-time voters who will be voting in the next election for the first time. What that poll showed was that over 75% of them not only identified as right-wing, but close to 60% of them identified as messianic. So it's not just they're conservatives necessarily, but that there is the messianic worldview that is totally informed the settler colonial project. And then the other moment, which was almost humorous, if not terrifying, was, of course, this past week, there was a big interview done between Tucker Carlson and the U.S. Israel, Mike Huckabee, where Mike Huckabee put out this biblical claim that Israel has the right to control from the Nile in Egypt to the Euphrates in Iraq. And everyone said that that is ridiculous. And Yair Lapid, of all people, who is thought of as the head of the liberal opposition within Israel, in a press conference for his political party said, no, actually, no, he's right. I agree with him. It might not be politically possible right now, but no, this is our position, that the Bible gives us control of all of this. To me, that is that this contradiction no longer exists. This proves this that Israeli, Jewish Israeli society has formed this consensus, as you're describing it, behind this vision. So I guess this all leads me to ask you, and one of the big themes I'm going to want to keep coming back to is, so Israel has this vision. You say, you raise this question, what will stop Israel? It seems clear that that will not be Jewish Israeli society that does that. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I agree. I think there are no dynamics of change from within that in the foreseeable future can change the reality that we are experiencing today. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, it always reminds me the these exit points that you have in history. And it was very clear that Judaism as a faith after the Roman occupation of Palestine, at least as far as most of its thinkers, its rabbis, its great teachers was concerned, was choosing what one can call the rabbinical Jewish tradition, namely the need to learn, to repeat, to make the world a better place. It had nothing to do with sovereignty, control, and domination. And the way and you saw it in the interview that you mentioned, that both Christian Zionists, and I think it started with them, historically speaking, before it started with Jewish thinkers, resurrected a kind of a Hebraic Judaism rather than a rabbinical one, namely taking a tribal community that the Bible, that is not an historical document, refers to as part of its set of stories, and you know, kind of a tribal existence that formed also tribal kingdoms, but the Hebraic tribe was not the only one around and was not the most important one, and it was swallowed again and again, like all the other tribes, by more formidable kingdoms at the time. That to say that the stories about that particularly small tribal kingdom and its relationship with the much larger kingdoms around it between 3000 BC to 2000 BC, all the way to the beginning of the Roman occupation of Palestine in around, if I remember correctly, something like 66 BC, to look at all this period and to say, this is actually a period when there was Jewish sovereignty over much of the Eastern Mediterranean, is such a scholarly fabrication. It is such a manipulation of a book that is has moral imperatives for the faithful rather than a political and historical map. Is something that we cannot deal with in a scholarly way, because you know they're not confused by facts or by logic, but it. The moment it is subscribed to, as your first point of data showed, Adam, the moment it is subscribed to by a large number of people, and I would say that the percentages among the political and military and security elite in Israel is even higher than 60% now, shows us that if the world, the region, Jewish communities, doesn't matter who you are, have genuine concern for the Palestinians and their fate, and believe that there is a connection between a just solution in Palestine to just solutions of other problems we are facing, both in the region and further afield, then, yeah, there is a clear strategic conclusion out of it. You know, you are not asking Europeans to play mediators between Palestinians and Jews. You ask them to defend the Palestinians. And they have the power to do that, even without the Americans. let alone, of course, hoping that American politics would produce change in the future that would also enable them to play, after years of playing a negative role, to play a more constructive role, not only in the case of Israel and Palestine, but of the Arab world in general.
Before we go to your book, because you know you address actually all these themes in the book, and we will feature it in just a moment. Can you share with us a little bit about the divisions within Israeli society in general? Because it is something that, you know, when we talk about Israel, people mention the basics regarding military occupation, ethnic cleansing, apartheid rule, what have you. There is a distinction, of course, between, or that used to be made more than today, between the Netanyahu, you know, character, personality, and politics, and then what Israel is or ought to be. And then, of course, the more far right that Netanyahu has brought in. And, of course, the lines have become so blurry that right now that it's difficult to recognize those differences, not least with the announcement of Lapid, the recent, I mean, the one that Adam was talking about, which, you know, just shatters this idea that, oh, the problem is Netanyahu. And others would say, no, the problem is Israel. And then it's becoming clearer what the issue is. However, can you just give us a quick rundown of divisions within Israeli society and the extent to which things have changed after the genocide, if at all?
Yeah. You can make it an easy kind of analysis. You think about cultural, political culture as kind of the framework in which you want to look at these divisions, rather than socioeconomic, you know, and so on, which is also a fair reference point to the differences in the society. But I will pull it aside because I think the socioeconomic differences that exist in any society, although they play a very important role in the life of Israelis, and would have an impact on the ability of the world, I think, also to influence Israel eventually. What you are referring to is more the political culture, I think, rather than socioeconomic differences. And as I said, they do correlate sometimes, but I think it's more important here to talk about the cultural political differences. And I think what you have here is almost like the difference between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem in many ways. Take Tel Aviv without Jaffa, not Tel Aviv Jaffa, as they call it, Tel Aviv itself, a city that tries to emulate New York in its life as a city, where the elite that deals with high tech and finance, and also with the military and security elite, would live there or in similar kind of places, leading what you can call still secular life, would kind of view themselves as pluralistic in their relationship to LGBT communities and so on, but would not see any contradiction between that and the fact, for instance, as a good colleague of mine says, that Tel Aviv is the only Western metropolis that doesn't have any Muslims in it. So living 10 minutes, 10 kilometers or 15 kilometers from the Gaza Strip, but not at all caring what goes on there, and are very proud of sending their children to the army, and especially to, you know, elite units that do most of the execute most of the brutal policies towards the Palestinians. A weird mixture of a pluralism of a kind, secularism of a kind, a Western style of life that politically is translated into the policies of Yair Lapid that Adam mentioned, kind of center and center right, hoping that somehow they are seen in the outside world as part of Western democracy and still believing that you can do that and at the same time continue genocide, ethnic cleansing, and oppression. That's a group that also benefits from the military arms industry of Israel. They make a lot of money out of it, from the high-tech, the pharmaceutical corporations, that some of them emanated from Israel, but now have like octopuses, you know, pangs all over the world. Many of them have dual nationalities. And these are the people who are leaving, by the way. They are, on the other hand, you have the political culture of Jerusalem. It's a very good example because it's made of settlers who are now almost 1 million, if you take Jerusalem into account, you know, and so on, who are sending their children to the army, are harassing the Palestinians with the complicity of the army in the West Bank, in the greater Jerusalem area, and every now and then also enter the Palestinian communities inside Israel, especially in the mixed towns, to harass them. And they are in political alliance, not necessarily in cultural alliance, but then they are now in a political alliance with Orthodox Jews who also have a quick natural growth in terms of their percentage in the society. And what is very interesting to kind of follow is the battle over the question of conscription. And I think this is a division that might rattle a little bit this clear dichotomy that I'm putting here, you know, between the old Israel and the new one that I call in my book, the State of Judea, you know, the theocratic messianic one. In order to sustain the messianic new state of Israel, which I call Judea, namely the theocratic, the racist, the one that was to expand even beyond Palestine, you need a strong army. You need young people recruiting voluntarily and happily to the military force that would achieve these visions. And what the Hamas was able to do in the last two and a half years, with some help of Hezbollah, although not a significant help of the Hezbollah, was to show that the invincible Israeli army is exhausted in terms of the ability of its soldiers to go back and forth to the battlefield, to be in a war condition longer than a year. And since most of them are reserve soldiers, at the same time maintaining their normal life and businesses, study or whatever. You can't do both. You cannot be 400 days, not 400, sorry. You cannot be 300 days in a year in the army and maintain normal life outside the army in the remaining 65 days. Now the army says very clearly, if you want to change it, we need to recruit the tens of thousands of young Orthodox Jews who since 1948 are exempted from military service, from the compulsory military service. If you don't recruit them, you won't have the army for your vision. And this is now the big battle. If Netanyahu would fall in the 2026 election, it will not be about the genocide in Gaza. It was not even about his failure as the head of the state to foresee the Hamas attack. That is not what is going to bring him down. What is going to bring him down is need to remain in alliance with the Orthodox parties and allow them to continue to exempt their youngsters from military service. This is something that looks to the foreign media as a marginal, insignificant theme. I think it goes to the heart of the second challenge I was talking about. Can Judaism be nationalism? It goes to the heart of Zionism as in its present form, as a sustainable form of ideology. Because it's not enough to have an ideology. You need the capacity to implement it. And since this is the kind of ideology we're talking, you need not only financial capacity, you need military capacity. So how are you going to do this? without these tens of thousands of Orthodox Jews that you are exempt. And even if you don't exempt them, will they be the material that would be able to, you know, fulfill your dreams of the new mini empire of Israel? I'm not sure about that.
Adam, would you like to follow up, or should we address the book?
No, I mean, I think moving to the book would be this is a perfect segue to it. So, I mean, I certainly have some questions. I'm also a little bit desperate at this point in the conversation for some good news. So I know that part of the book.
Okay, let's do that.
Forward here, and I view this question as, you know, we've talked about the ideology and all the international forces aligned behind this vision that we've been seeing play out in 2.5 years of genocide. What is the alternative path idealistically? We could all imagine what a utopia might look like, but what are the material things that could happen? The title of the book includes 8 steps to a better future. What are some of these steps? What could be done?
What I was trying to do in the book was to say that it's important to distinguish between two things. One is between the near future and the more distant future, and not to regard the distant future as too distant, in the sense that it doesn't require us to think about it, because the near future, and we devoted most of our conversation so far to the very near future, and it does look bleak. One, you cannot tell the people of Gaza with any responsibility, don't worry, in a year or two your life will be better. It would not be fair to do that. But in the long term, I do think that there are processes that I already detected, and I try to claim that I detect them as an analyst and not only as an activist, that show that the more distant future includes both, and that's the second point I'm making, includes processes on which we probably have very little impact on, but can have huge impact on us in terms of creating more favorable conditions for ending ethnic cleansing, occupation, genocide, and so on, and processes which can do the same, but need active participation by people who care about what's happening on the ground, whether they are Palestinians, whether they are pro-Palestinians, whether they are people with the modicum of consciousness and morality in them in the world. And I think it's important to talk about it not as a false, you know, dose of optimism. Let's say to people, you know, listen to Ilan Perper's talk and you'll be more optimistic. That's not the idea. The idea is that these processes are already here and they are happening, and we should focus on those that we can influence, but be aware of those that we cannot influence, because if we are not all living under the genocide in Gaza. We are not all living under conditions where we cannot really strategize, because we have to survive tomorrow. So don't ask us to strategize, to think about the long term. But we're not all, not those of us who live in historical Palestine and not those of us who care of historical Palestine. We're not under these conditions. So we can not only strategize about the long terms, detect them and strategize about the long processes, maybe even have the ability to impact some of them, to shorten the distance between the short-term calamities in the making and the long-term possibilities of getting out of it. And I'm optimistic about it, because I every day makes me feel that the processes I detected of both kinds, the ones I think many of us have no influence over, and those that we can, are happening. So let me talk about those we can, because these are the revolutions I'm talking about in the book. I try to talk about those we don't have an impact on, but they're less important from our perspective in this conversation. So one is a very clear one. Sometimes you think that there's no need to talk about the Palestinian National Movement, its fragmentation, the quality of its present leadership, and so on, because, you know, the balance of power is such that, as someone put it, it doesn't matter, even if they had the best quality leadership in the world, it wouldn't help. This is true to a certain point, but it doesn't absolve a conversation of renewing the PLO or offering another organization, allowing the young generation a far more important role in the driver's seat, listening to the younger generation, which has a much less fragmented and factionalized vision of the future, far more united in the vision of the future, and find a way of helping us to get rid of those who pretend to present the Palestinians, doesn't matter where they are, by saying we are still a national movement that strives to have a two-state solution, which really allows the calamity to continue and would allow the calamity to continue if this would be not the discourse of the world, if this would be the discourse of the Palestinian leadership. I really think it's one of the most dangerous discourses that Palestinians who claim to be representative of the national movement in whatever capacity are still adhering to. For me, this is a very dangerous pathway forward. A second revolution is one that's already happening, but I think we should push it. And I'm not putting them in terms of priority. I'm just giving the enumerating them. Changes in the Jewish political community, the anti-Zionist Jewish movement that is resurrected, that is joining the solidarity movement with the Palestinians, I think is very important. I think the connection between indigenous struggles around the world, minority struggles around the world, working class and union struggle that are now intersecting more significantly with Palestine as an epicenter of injustice that reflects injustices that they themselves are facing. Look at the transformation of the Arab, of the African American community in terms of its relationship with Palestine. All this has to be accelerated, I think, augmented, because it has an influence. Talking about the essence of politics, the kind of politicians we have, especially in the EU, but not only, you know, sort of self-centered, low-caliber politicians, and hoping that the younger generation would replace them is another kind of revolution that I'm talking about. But also, and that with this, I would finish this response, using a connection between the amazing new generation of scholars that we have, who are either Palestinians, semi-Palestinians, ideological Palestinians, namely not biological one, but feel ideologically Palestinians. An amazing human capital. An amazing, that I remember only such a human capital back in the 70s in Palestine and before the Nakba. A human capital that can produce and unpack ideas such as the right of return, a decolonized Palestine, reconnecting Palestine to the Mashrek, to the Eastern Mediterranean, into proper programs, proper policy papers, proper projects, and finally, and give us a lot of something to bite into when we are talking about alternative to the current realities. And finally, the very complex position of 2 million Palestinians that are crucial for both changing the orientation of the Palestinian National Movement, but also the fate of Palestine. And these are the Palestinian citizens of Israel, who still believe that they can play in both political fields, the Israeli political field and the Palestinian political field. They would have to take a strategic decision. Where are they going to play and in what role? I think all these, and maybe I forgot some of them, but they're all in the book, are kind of energizing, I think, actions and activities that accelerate those more positive developments and bring them forward rather than looking at them in the distant future. I think we can, and we can talk about all the time narrowing gaps, like the gap between what the political elites and civil societies want on Palestine, the gap between the current politics of Palestine and the ones aspired to by a more younger generation of Palestinians, the gap between the inside politics, the outside politics. All these are gaps that can be narrowed, and the more they are tightened, they create a more powerful global alliance for Palestine, because we are facing a global alliance for Israel that is very formidable, cynical, and powerful if we want to change the reality.
Ilan, before we go to the question of public opinion, because this is a major corner or dimension of what we have been doing here, I would like to sort of ask a rather nerdy question, and with respect to the actual table of contents of the book. So, okay. If you can tell us just very quickly, I mean, as quickly or as thoroughly as you'd like, if you can just tell us what is happening within the book and the actual table of contents. We have three parts. The first part is the collapse. The second is the way forward. And the third is post-Israel Palestine 2048. And it's divided into a lot of very interesting topics. If you can just guide us through this so that people can, first of all, develop an interest in reading the material, because, you know, a podcast is nice and everything, but there's no substitute to actually reading the material, which is one of the problems we have, not just on the quote-unquote other side, but also on quote-unquote the side that is fighting for equality and freedom and so on for Palestinians. So if you can go through this, and I'll leave it up to you.
Yeah, definitely. So first of all, what the book tries to show is what, and I borrowed it from a student of mine, a concept called the orthodoxy of peace, namely to show what was wrong with even the genuine attempts to provide a solution in Palestine. I start with this. I think it's very important to push it out of the way, because otherwise we go back to what we are hearing now, the conversation about the day after in Gaza, as if there was a war in Gaza, and now we are again at a period of peace negotiations that would produce something better. The second part of the book is indeed, or the second chapter in the first part, is those cracks that I was talking about, namely those indications that the Zionist project is imploding, both from within, both in its relationship with the Jewish communities around the world, its relationship with the civil society around the world, it's in its microeconomic realities, in its ability to maintain an invincible army, and dealing with the social kind of factionalism and cultural factionalism that exists in Israel. The second kind of pointing to those processes, I already answered Adam about this, that I think we have an input, and it begins with, and I should preface by saying I tried as much as I could to answer the question that I put in these about these processes of, namely, what should we do, what should be done, as much as I could to connect it to what I hear, especially from younger Palestinian scholars and activists, because I thought their input is not only important because of its quality, but because the whole idea of the book is that if the Palestinian generation would not be in the driver's seat towards decolonization, even if Israel disintegrates, it can disintegrate for a very long time and not necessarily be replaced by something better. We have seen it in the decolonization of Northern Africa and Africa itself and other places. So there's a kind of a warning there about this. Secondly, it looks at the whole problem of the international justice system that was exposed in its deficiencies, especially when the genocide started in Gaza. Going back to the idea that you are facing an institutional infrastructure for universal justice that was formed after the Second World War, when most of the world was still colonized. And you can see the result of this in the way that the Global South in particular lost any confidence in the international justice system, especially in its engagement with the Gaza issue and so on. So I think that's something that can be done and can be worked upon. Then I go to more practical issues that everybody would agree should be part of decolonizing Palestine, and claiming that there are also very constructive ideas about it. For example, how to implement the right of return, what to do with the Jewish settlements that were built after 1967. Some of them are urban sprawls. What should they be done? Should they be wiped out? Should they be part of, should decolonization also include reconciliation? You know, these are, and again, I'm not just bringing my own ideas. I'm trying to engage with what I hear from the generation that I think much more than I would have to deal with it and can already deal with it. The reconnecting of Palestine to the Arab world, something the Zionist movement did. It totally took it out of the Arab world and put it in Europe and in Western Europe. What would it do to Jewish collective identity, not only in Palestine, outside of Palestine, because Zionism claimed authority of Jewish identities, not only in Palestine, but tried to change the whole question of collective Jewish identity outside of Palestine, especially in the United States, but not only there. The last part is the one I really hesitated to do. I will tell you why I thought of doing it. I reread few revolutionary literature before I wrote the book, and in one of them, I think it was Gramsci. I'm a bit tired, so I don't totally remember. I think it was Gramsci who said, "You cannot have a revolution without imagination," and I thought that in the bleak moments that we are all experiencing, there is a difference. And I remember I had this debate with a good Palestinian friend of mine. I think there's a difference between hope and imagination. Hope is, you know, you're not doing much. You're hopeful that things will happen. Imagination forces you to say how exactly you want the reality to be. And if you're an activist, I think it's only natural that you will start to think, how do I get to that reality? But if you are not imagining the other reality, I don't think you work very well towards it. You're only reacting to the dismal reality that you are facing, but you're not working for the other reality. And I think there was something, of course, in the Third World revolutionary movement that was very important, the imagination. So as an historian, I connected to a genre that we have in professional history, which is called the history of the future. There is a serious genre of history. It's not a pastime. It's serious. So what I produced a document of the future. I didn't try to be a novelist. I didn't try to impress people by my ability to concoct fascinating a narrative. Some of my friends who are authors thought that this was what I was trying to do and said, you know, you're not Tolstoy or something. I said, fine, I accept it. I humbly accept it. But I said that was not the idea. That it's a document. It's not a piece of literature as such. And I thought a document is the closest document to me is a diary. A diary of an old man who sits in Haifa in 2048. Of course, a symbolic date, not a scientific date, a symbolic date. And looks back at the transformation that have a lot of setbacks, a lot of unfortunate moments in it. But we all reached 2048 scarred, wounded, but finally beginning to enjoy a different reality. And I thought it was important to do that for me, first of all, but I hope that it resonated with other people as well, as a form of not just an intellectual or even a literary exercise, but also as an activist exercise, which I think is very important. And I don't want to give everything that's in the book, but one of the most enjoyable passages I wrote, but only people who live in Haifa would know what I was talking about. I don't know if both of you had the chance or ability to visit Haifa. One of the worst monstrosities of Haifa is a huge tower in the shape of a missile. The architects claims it's in the shape of a ship. It's not, in the shape of a missile. That was built instead of the most beautiful part of old Haifa, the Saraya, the Ottoman Saraya, was known for its beauty all over the Arab world. And instead of that, they have built this huge, horrible tower. And in the book, I describe the celebration when we are all watching detonating and destroying this tower, without the people in it, of course, as part of a symbolic sense that we are not only building a new future, we are reconnecting to legacies of the past that have been erased, but to my mind can be retrieved.
Adam, did you want to follow up, or should we move to the question of public opinion? I also put a clearer version of the table of contents, because somebody, there was a comment internally from our side that the copy from Beacon Press wasn't the table of contents from Beacon Press, which I'm assuming is the publisher, correct, Elon?
In America, yeah.
Yeah, the one that's available online wasn't very clear. The one from Amazon is clear, so there you go. So, Adam, shall we move to the question of?
Why don't you ask your question about popular opinion?
Elon, we constantly talk about. We constantly talk about the question of public opinion, and our guests have had a lot of interesting things to say about public opinion, especially in the United States, regarding Israel and how the sort of exponential, dramatic decline of Israel's reputation in the United States has been documented in poll after poll after poll, week after week after week, and month after month, or I should have said them in reverse, not least in relation to the question of the war in Iran. So first, it was the genocide. Second, it was the starvation and collective punishment after the March 2025 ceasefire, in quotation marks always. And now it's about Israel, quote unquote, dragging the United States into another choice war, which is a choice word for this term or for this reality, and so on. Now, to what extent do people in Israel, both state and society, leadership and society, politicians and otherwise, take seriously those polls? And it seems that there has been a point in the past several weeks or months where we, at least those of us who follow Israeli press and television through translations, have seen a sort of nonchalant attitude, a sort of giving up following what is happening in the United States, given that raw power is at this point sufficient and they cannot do very much about public opinion besides buying TikTok and controlling CBS News and things of the sort, which don't immediately change these opinions and probably never would. So my question is, can you tell us about this question of public opinion and how it reverberates in Israel regarding U.S. public opinion, but also broader public opinion, if you want? Yeah. And second, do you think this is reversible, this trend in public opinion or this reality, which is also structural in some ways, is reversible?
Yeah, well, I think already in 2010, when Netanyahu decided to open a new ministry called the Ministry for Strategic Affairs, which was in many ways a response to the fact that Israel was losing the battle in many quarters of the global civil society, and the beginning of understanding that there is a shift in the United States regarding Israel. I think the message of this ministry and similar agencies that Israel afterwards established was that we already lost the battle over the public opinion, but public opinion is not important. It's a bit of an ambivalent relationship, attitude. On the one hand, it is following a narrative which says public opinion that is sections of the public opinion that are against Israel are anti-Semitic, even if they are Jews, you know, they're anti-Semitic. And therefore, there's no need to invest in them anyway. You know, they are lost cases. However, what matters is the position of political elite, economic elite, financial elites, military elites. So you put all your efforts there, and you live with it, as you live with the need to fight all the time, the Palestinians and the Arabs, and to win, as you live with the need to oppress other people all the time, as if this is what life is all about for that particular perspective. So I do think, but why is it ambivalent? Because those who were part of the bigger Israeli lobby in the world, especially those in the United States, who are still closer to the Democratic Party or are still a bit of an older generation of lobbyists, if you want, or advocates, are still thinking that they have the power, as they did in the past, by using coercion, intimidation, or seduction, by also changing the position of a small community, a church, a university, a campus, and so on. So you can see still simultaneously a lack of interest in Israel and what goes on in the civil society, and yet a wish to say, no, but they're not all against us, you know, because there's still among some Israelis a wish also to be morally acceptable. In some sections of society. But I think this is changing. This is really changing. And the easiest way for them to do it is really to package it as anti-Semitism. So not to package it at all as being driven by a moral perspective of the world, by even a different Jewish moral perspective on the world. Rather, that's old and new anti-Semitism. So I think that is what is working. Now, you ask about changes, you know, possible changes. I do think that both in terms of what public opinion outside of Israel can do and what public opinion in Israel might be able to do, there's one similar point that I think connects the two. And this from an activist point of view, I think, much more than an academic one. And this is kind of the distinction between a purist. I'm sorry, I'm deviating a little bit from your question, but I think it's sort of, I feel it's important to say, and I'm also near exhaustion. So we will have to finish soon, I'm afraid. but I think it's important to say this, is that to differentiate between a purist approach to building alliances for Palestine, or even building alliances in Israel that still maybe have some potential for change, a purist approach, and a more pragmatic approach, or distinguishing between people who are ad hoc allies for a struggle, especially if you are facing a genocide and there are urgent needs, and those you will want to build a coalition with for longer term strategizing and envisaging a different future. They are not the same people always. We sometimes fail in doing that, I think. We keep thinking that they are one and the same, and they are not. I think that the moment some Israelis are now realizing that there is a right-wing backlash in Israel in the United States against Israel, namely isolationist right-wing supporters of Trump saying, who needs this state? Who needs supporting it, you know, when there are alternatives? And who wants America to be involved there anyway? You know, apart from taking over maybe the oil fields, we need them. But we don't need Israel for that. This is something would be interesting to follow, to see how would the Israelis deal when those who they said, okay, these are our natural allies now, forget about the left, forget about Jewish progressive communities and so on. What do you do when these people desert you? When these people desert you, what are you going to do? I think that's one of the reasons they're trying to strengthen in a very short-sighted way, I must say. They now have a very strong alliance with Modi in the BJP in India. You know, thinking about the BJP in India as the vision of the future is not understanding at all undercurrents in India itself. You know, this, it's like looking at history as a still. What you see is what you will have, instead of kind of strategizing, even from their perspective, the possibility that history is cyclic and you might find yourself with a different set of values, international community, even a different economic reality that might change, is not at all factored, I think, in their analysis of public opinion or their analysis of policies and so on.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I promise, thank you so much for your time. We have one last question before we wrap up.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
a magisterial presentation. You've taken us 2,000 years in the past. You've even taken us 20 years in the future. And I just want to return to the very beginning when we were talking. And in your first comments, you were laying out this image of what Israel is trying to accomplish right now. And you said they will not succeed. And I wonder, just as my last question, you've laid out a lot of information and a lot of opportunities and a lot of these changing dynamics, but why will they not succeed?
Yeah, okay. First of all,
just a spoiler alert. Spoiler alert for those who don't want to know the finale.
Yeah. Okay. First of all, because of the Palestinian resistance and resilience. You know, the last visit I did recently to the West Bank was to Jenin, the people who were ousted of the Jenin, as you know, I don't know if you probably know that they were ousted of the Jenin refugee camp. Teenagers. They're not going away. They're not giving up the struggle. Yes, the balance of power is totally against them. But they're 16 and they're 17. And although Israel kills a lot of these teenagers, they're there. And I think that's very important. The Palestinian resistance and resilience, not only on the ground, in not giving up on the international solidarity movement and demanding, rightly so, even a more representative voice in that solidarity movement. Sometimes they were marginalized in the solidarity movement. I think they are now asserting their place in the movement itself, which is also very, very important. I do believe that what I call the dead body of the two-state solution that is in the morgue would finally have its funeral. And when it will have its funeral, it would be easier for the world to see that this is the Palestinian position, not the two-state position. And this would require a different reaction. It's easier to react, to say, what do you want to be more pious than the Palestinians? They all they want is a small state under Israeli control in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. When this will change, I think this is also something to be optimistic about, that it would fail the conversation about the day after that is part of the immunity shield that Israel enjoys in building that new Israel. I think economically, there is an illusion that the macroeconomics data, which is very positive, is the one that determines the economic viability of society. I don't accept it. I think the microeconomic data is important. The growing gap between the rich and the poor in Israel, the large number of Israelis who join those who live under the poverty line, the fact that the state is pushing so much money to the army and the settlements and Jewish project, as they call it, asserting the Hebraic Jewish identity, comes at the expense of providing welfare to the society. I think that the army itself is losing some of its more high-tech quality personnel that I'm not excited about because they do terrible things, but without them, it's a far less efficient army. It would be a far less efficient army in the future. And let us remember, any possible change in the Arab world, even to the level of kind of deteriorating a bit even the relationship with Israel, would remind Israelis that all they faced in the last, I would say since 1982, but even I would go as back as 1973, they faced a military struggle with small guerrilla movements without air force, navies, anything, a small popular resistance movement. And let's face it, they were not that successful in the end of the day. Yes, the state of Israel didn't fall, but they didn't succeed in implementing their own aims towards these opponents, if you want. So what would happen if the conventional armies or you know, a military kind of buildup and so on? So I think that the best way of putting it is the following way, Adam. The dynamics of what I call the state of Judea, namely a rogue state that intensifies, unfortunately, its cruelty against the Palestinians, its aggressiveness against its neighbors. There is a dialectical process here. The more it goes through this pathway, the more difficult it is for those who still protect it, that still immunize it, to do this. It will become more and more difficult. And I think eventually it would be impossible. It would be impossible, either for moral reasons, but I'm not naive, then for financial reasons, economic reasons, strategic reasons, call it what they want. Israel would transform from a bonanza and an asset into a liability. This is going to happen. It's a liability to have someone like that. Even Trump in some more sane moments, and he doesn't have many of those, was desperate about the Israelis, as he said himself. I mean, even he, as from his business kind of man perspective, found it impossible to work with them sometimes. And these are just indications of what we are going to see, I think, in the future. And someone like even Mohammed bin Salman, who has already commented that there's a limit to what he can do against a population of 23 million people who are citizens of his country. He's not a small kingdom in the desert. All these things would come to a head, I think. And I don't know when, but they will happen. And they will limit the power of Israel to destroy. Hopefully they will open up, and that's the book, open up a new era in building something very different from what we have today.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. And thank you so much,
Ilan, for this. And we kept you for 90 minutes.
You did?
Okay, that's why I'm so excited. Okay. It went by so fast for us. I know it probably didn't go as fast for you.
Thank you.
And I hope that we can speak with you again. There are several other topics to address, but we will be connecting again with you soon. Thank you so much. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you, Adam.
Being a remarkable co-host. We will be back next week with interviews, or later this week when this airs, with Mu'in Rabbani, and then Noor Ariqat, Shir Hever, and if few others that are in the works. Thank you all so much, and have a wonderful day, Ilan and Adam.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. Thank you. Salam, salam.
Thank you.